Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors. Dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
It's a Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Today, we're going to start off with municipal elections. A little later in the program, the euphoria on the part of Democrats over those results in Virginia, New Jersey. We heard in the top of the hour news that Medicaid expansion vote in Maine, significant as well. Dennis Goldford will be along to give us his analysis on those potential bellwethers. First of all, though, we want to look at some of the election results here in Iowa. Joining us to do that, Chris Larimer, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Northern Iowa. Hi, Chris.
Hello, Ben.
So let's look at some of the municipal races that caught your eye. What's first on your list?
Well, I think first one on the list is the wide-open race in Cedar Rapids, where you had Ron Corbett retiring after stepping aside after two terms to run for governor, the Republican side in the Republican primary. And so you had a wide-open race in Cedar Rapids. You had eight candidates running, and none of the eight got to the 50% required to win the election outright. And so now we have a runoff with Monica Vernon, and she'll be challenged by Brad Hart in that runoff. But what's interesting there is obviously Monica Vernon is someone who was once a statewide candidate. She was mm-hmm. also a candidate for the first congressional district, so it's a it received quite a bit of attention. She was the top vote getter at 30%, but not to the 50% required.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Any indications there? Once it's only two names are on the ballot. Monica Vernon with, 30% of the vote, far from that 50% to avoid mm-hmm. a runoff.
Right.
But from what I'm getting, far ahead of Brad Hart.
Yeah, she was quite a ways ahead of Brad Hart. I think about 1,800 votes separated the two candidates there. I think, the challenge with trying to predict local elections, I think it's even more difficult than trying to predict state or federal elections, is that, these are such local races, they're such personal races. And then particularly when you're talking about a runoff in a municipal race, turnout is always the difficult thing to try to predict, because mm-hmm. you never know how many people are going to show up to vote again about 1 month after they just voted in a municipal election. It's hard enough to get people out for a municipal election, let alone a runoff. So, from an outsider's perspective, you would think Monica Vernon has the advantage just simply by name recognition, being on the ballot multiple times recently in Cedar Rapids and statewide. But I think, we just have to wait and see.
Mm-hmm. On that point, too, is the Cedar Rapids mayor a good place to advance your political prospects? Monica Vernon already with something of a statewide recognition for the reasons that you mentioned. But if she would win, would this be perhaps a good position to run for Congress again?
Well, I think it's potentially a stepping stone. I think anytime you are a big city mayor, you get a lot of attention as someone who is up and coming in whatever political party you're in. And so I think it could be that the Cedar Rapids mayor is a potential stepping stone. But I would say that for any large city, whether it's in Iowa or any other state, mm-hmm. being a big city mayor, we know, is generally that first step towards statewide or federal office.
Mm-hmm. What other municipal elections come to the top here?
Well, I think, you obviously have Cedar Rapids, and you also have the city of Ames. In both cases, two large cities in Iowa and two cities that had a mayor for a relatively long period of time and now are getting new mayors. And so the city of Ames, Ann Campbell stepped aside had been mayor since 2006. John Haleo is the new mayor in Ames. And so, it'll be interesting to see what happens there. Anytime you have a longtime mayor step aside, it's always interesting to watch whether or not the direction of the city changes, what, residents of the city are looking for.
Mm-hmm. An interesting story about the win yesterday by the embattled mayor of Muscatine. We've mm-hmm. talked about that before on this program, not when you were a part of it, but Diana Broderson, I think.
Broderson, yes.
Broderson, you tell us that story. It's interesting.
Well, yeah, so earlier this year, she was ousted by her own city council. There was an accusation that she violated city code by meeting with members of the city government, not under apparently or alleged proper conditions in terms of meeting in secret. So the city council decided to remove her from office. A district court judge came in and then said that the city council had overstepped its bounds and reinstalled her in office. And so now she was up for for re-election after all of that. And she won actually quite easily. Last I saw, she received 59% of the vote in Muscatine, and three of the city council members, incumbent city council members, did not win re-election. So, a little bit of turbulence there in Muscatine.
Mm-hmm. What else caught your eye yesterday, Chris?
I think, you know, just certainly around here in Waterloo, Cedar Falls, we had a couple of mayoral races in Waterloo, one of, you know, five largest cities in Iowa. We had a mayor in Quentin Hart running unopposed and obviously won re-election there. But then we had Mayor Jim Brown, who had won election to just recent or had just served one term as mayor of Cedar Falls, was easily re-elected for the mayor of Cedar Falls. And so watching that one, we had a couple of incumbent council members in Waterloo not be reelected, and then we have a runoff in the city of Cedar Falls for the at-large city council position. So again, that will be one that's interesting to watch, and again, watching, trying to get a sense of turnout as far as the level of excitement for a runoff election, not for mayor, but just a runoff for an at-large city council position. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, with all these races, just trying to, I don't have all the numbers yet, but just trying to get a sense of enthusiasm or the extent to which voters are really engaged in these municipal elections. Most of these elections seem to hover right around 15 to 20 to 22% turnout. But again, going forward in a month for the cities that have runoffs, it'll be interesting if they can keep it at that 15 to 20%.
Mm-hmm. In just a moment, we'll be going to Dennis Goldford for his look at the national bellwethers, we could say here. But I wonder, Chris, when we talk at the level of municipal elections and some of the outcomes that you've described here, is there any connection that you can discern with sort of the national conversation, or are these municipal elections any sort of bellwether for the state's political mood as a whole, or are they just sort of disconnected and each municipal area is its own thing?
Well, the difficulty is obviously that these municipal elections are nonpartisan, and so it's not as though you're seeing a Democrat or Republican on the ballot, and then as the voter goes in to cast his or her ballot, they're thinking Democrat, Republican, and then perhaps thinking about larger figures within the political party. And so, you know, they are very local. The only way that those connections are made is if you have candidates that may have been outspoken about talking about, you know, Donald Trump or talking about Barack Obama or Hillary Clinton or talking about the Democrats or Republicans. I think that's when those connections are made. But usually those are done on a more personal level. So I think trying to say that these are bellwethers or trying to get a connection between what happens at the municipal level to the state or federal level is a little bit more tenuous there. But I think just in terms of voter enthusiasm, I try to at least look at turnout. But without a partisan or a political party affiliation on the ballot, I think that becomes difficult.
Mm-hmm. Before we say goodbye, Chris, what is your feeling about 2018? Now we're a year away from the surprise win of Donald Trump. In November of 2016, we're a year away from the 2018 midterms. What can you say about it?
Well, I think right now it's shaping up to be, and this may sound unusual, but it's right now shaping up to be somewhat of a predictable midterm election. And I say that in the sense that typically the president's party loses election or loses seats in Congress in a midterm election. And right now, the number one predictor of that is presidential approval. And we have a president whose approval rating, by most accounts, is in the high 30s. And so that would seem to suggest that the Republican Party is going to have a difficult time in 2018. And we've seen a number of retirements on the Republican side in terms of members of Congress. You know, the so-called generic ballot test in terms of if a voter would vote for a Democrat or Republican in 2018 seems to favor Democrats by a margin that is similar to previous years when they've had good years in terms of thinking back to 2006. So right now it would seem to slightly favor Democrats, but the challenge certainly in Iowa for Democrats is turnout. We know that turnout drops significantly between a presidential year and a midterm year. We're usually 400,000 to 500,000 fewer votes in a midterm year compared to a presidential year just in the state of Iowa. So if that's the case, we know that the reliable voters tend to be older, more and lean slightly more conservative. So it may seem nationally like it's setting up well for Democrats, but I think we're still too far out to really know if Democrats are going to have sort of that wave election. Right now, I would just say it's slightly leaning in their favor.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned the historically low approval ratings that this president has, given the place he is in his presidency here. In the 30s, in the high 30s, I think most polls are putting the president with his approval rating. But we also have some GOP senators, Corker, Flake, McCain, speaking loudly against this this president. I wonder, our senators, Grassley, and Ernst so far holding to the president, if you can broadly say it that way. I wonder your thoughts on you know, how if one, the president's popularity would diminish, or is that third, his base, so solid that it, you don't see it diminishing any further in terms of the poll numbers? And what would it take in terms of unpopularity to have more GOP members of Congress jump from the Trump ship?
Well, I think in terms of his base, I would be surprised if it goes much lower, if it gets below 30%. I think there will probably always be a group within the electorate that is going to approve of the job that the president is doing. And we know that that's in part related to partisanship, that strong party connection that a lot of voters have. I don't know if we're going to see more defections from the Republican Party. I think the challenge for the Republican Party right now, and actually Dennis and I were talking about this last week, is just trying to understand what their message is. What is their agenda? What are they really trying to do? Because so far they've failed on health care. They failed on tax cuts. There's no clear direction on foreign policy or international trade. And so for voters who are hoping for some change, Republican voters hoping for some change, or even independents who are leaning toward the Republican Party, they haven't seen any sort of policy success at this point. And I think that's the larger challenge. And so for Republican members of Congress, they need to start thinking to 2018, do we need to start moderating our stances just so we get something done, so there is a clear message to voters going into the 2018 election?
Okay. Thank you very much. Chris Larimer, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Northern Iowa, thank you for stepping into our Cedar Falls studio.
Happy to do it, Ben, and be sure to ask Dennis some really hard questions.
Always do. It's a Politics Wednesday edition of River to River. A reminder that tomorrow, this will be interesting for you political junkies, the head of the Environmental Protection Agency, Scott Pruitt, is making some fundamental changes in the way the EPA gets its scientific advice. So tomorrow, though, on this program, I'll talk about the implications of this major shift. It's a shift of getting advice from scientists in academia to industry experts. So I'll talk tomorrow with environmental scientists Deb Swackhammer of the University of Minnesota and Peter Thorne of the University of Iowa. That's tomorrow on the program. But onward with Politics Wednesday. And upward with Dennis Goldford, who is in our Des Moines studio. Hi, Dennis.
I had to sit and listen to Larimer, so let's get serious.
Well, he challenged me to give you some really hard questions, so okay.
Yeah, I know.
We'll roll out the toughest ones. Professor of Political Science Department Chair at Drake University, Dennis, thanks for stepping into our studio. Let's talk about yesterday's elections. Listen to one view on it. In this hotly contested, nationally watched governor's race in Virginia, the Democrat, Ralph Northam, a decisive win over the Republican Ed Gillespie, sort of half embracing the president's brand of Republican politics. So at Northam's victory speech, there was a lineup of prominent Democrats introducing him. Virginia Senator Tim Kaine, previously the governor of Virginia, also Hillary Clinton's running mate in 2016, of course. He targeted Trump's directly in his remarks and suggested that this win is a vision of what is to come politically.
The president wisely chose to be thousands of miles away from the United States tonight because Virginia sent a strong message, the Trump-style division, pitting people against people. It is not the Virginia way. It is not the American way. We are leading the nation. We did it a long time ago, and we're doing it now. So thanks to all of you guys. On to 2018, on to 2020, with a progressive Virginia leading the way into the future. Thanks so much.
Okay, Dennis, before we get to you, a couple of other voices from yesterday. Virginia's other senator, Democrat Mark Warner, also previously Virginia's governor. This is what he had to say.
Not only Virginia Democrats, but Virginia independents, and yes, Virginia Republicans, who also reject the kind of divisive, negative, lowest common denominator politics. And you may have heard, we've not done as well as we could and should do in a lot of rural parts of Virginia, because really the promise of Virginia in the 21st century, and Ralph Northam realizes this, having grown up on the Eastern Shore, is you shouldn't have to leave your hometown to find a world-class job in the 21st century.
Okay, what about the victor? Northam himself says the elections are The results are important nationally.
Today, Virginians have answered and have spoken. Virginia has told us to end the divisiveness, that we will not condone hatred and bigotry, and to end the politics that have torn this country apart.
Three Democrats in succession there crowing that this is a turning of a corner. Do you see it that way, Dennis Goldford, or how much do you see it that way?
It certainly was a good night for Democrats, but whether that's sustainable is another question. As Chris noted, in midterm elections, you have a very different electorate from what you have in a presidential year, and in some ways different from what you have in off-year elections, which is what these were. And in midterm elections, and Chris and I both have been saying for a long time, you have a much more Republican electorate coming out to vote. I mean, just to give you a sense, in Iowa, there's always a fall off in turnout between a presidential year and a midterm year. And if you compare 2014, the vote in Iowa, with 2012, those particular races, Republicans turned out, their turnout dropped by 17%, which doesn't sound great. But Democratic turnout in Iowa dropped by 26%, and no party or independent turnout dropped by 40% here in Iowa. So you can see in Iowa, as in the rest of the country, turnout tends to drop in a midterm election. But it drops in particularly heavily among independents and Democrats, not as heavily among Republicans. So the turnout is the key for the midterm. And while Democrats did well yesterday and last night, the question is, can they get their folks to turn out in 2018 the way they got a lot of their folks to turn out, at least in the Washington, D.C. area in Virginia yesterday?
Mm-hmm. Of course, the other bellwether potentially that is being looked at, New Jersey. A blue state, definitely, but Democrat Phil Murphy winning and, of course, replacing, I think he's the, has been for some time, according to polls, the most unpopular governor in the country, Chris Christie. In his victory speech, Democrat Phil Murphy also targeting President Trump.
And all the while, we will stand firm for New Jersey's values and push back against the mean winds blowing at us from Washington, D.C. This is one of the first major elections since Donald Trump was elected. Tonight, New Jersey sent an unmistakable message to the entire nation. We are better than this.
Okay. Dennis, so if we're put a political advisor hat on you for a moment and have you open up your 2018 playbook. When we talk about messages that are being tested for 2018 that seem to be working here, what would you say are those messages, and how does that match up with the mood of the country going forward?
The Republican message was, well, what happened particularly in Virginia, Gillespie was your establishment Republican, which is typically tax cuts, supply side economics, cuts in entitlements, all those sorts of things. That wasn't a Trump message. And remember that while wealthy Trump voters tend to be Republicans first and Trump supporters second, the more white working class Trump voters tend to be Trump supporters first and Republicans second. So they've got to figure out what their message will be. And Gillespie in Virginia tried to, as some folks have called it, tried to have a campaign of Trumpism without Trump. And Steve Bannon and others would say that's going to succeed. And, of course, it didn't in this particular case. But Mr. Trump himself, other than immigration and jobs, didn't really have an agenda. Basically, he's doing his own particular reality show in the White House, and Republicans want him there simply as somebody with a pen that'll sign legislation they send up. Trump has no special position on taxes or on health care, things like that. He just wants a win, however it's defined. The problem for Democrats is that they didn't have a message in 2016. I mean, the Clinton message is basically, I'm a woman, it's our turn, and I'm not Trump. And that was not sufficient, obviously, to get the electoral vote she needed to get, particularly among what had been traditionally Democratic constituencies. So the Democrats, their fatal temptation here might be is if they focus more on being anti-Trump than actually having some sort of substantive agenda, mm-hmm. Some sort of vision that's more than a laundry list of particular policies.
Mm-hmm. Let's try to squeeze in one caller before the break. If you'd like to join our conversation, Dennis Goldford of Drake University with us. It's Politics Wednesday. Let's go to Reggie in Oskaloosa. He dialed 1-866-780-9100. Reggie, hi. What do you want to jump in with here?
Yeah, I kind of wanted to agree with your guest there that the election, for especially the governor's races, I don't think had a whole lot to do with the president, since the governors or the candidates were distancing themselves from the president, and I think that probably actually hurt him more than helped him. Mm-hmm. And the other thing I was wondering about is all the winners were saying how the president was being divisive after they ran that horrible ad in Virginia with the pickup and the Confederate flag and Gillespie's name on it.
I saw
and
that,
Yeah, and then they're talking about the division among the Republicans. I think that was very hypocritical.
Mm, okay, Reggie. Thanks for your view from Oskaloosa.
Thank you.
Yep, Dennis, comment quickly before we go to break about this, I guess I'll call it a half hug from Trump to Gillespie, or what was that little dance that we never had Trump going to campaign with Gillespie, did we?
No, we didn't. And again, Gillespie was more of an establishment candidate, and he tried to be Trumpism without Trump. And Trump supported him and had a robocall on his behalf. And then, of course, typically for Mr. Trump, he's not very loyal to people, even as he insists on loyalty from then toward him. He cut Gillespie loose, dropped him immediately, and said, well, he didn't embrace me enough. And I think that's what the caller suggested, that the Republican candidates were not sufficiently Trumpist in their approach. But winning candidates on both sides, on all sides, always interpret the election results in ways that are most favorable to their particular message. Whether that's in fact the case is another matter.
Mm-hmm. I wonder, will we see the president out campaigning for a lot of members in Congress in 2018? For our members in Congress, Rod Blum, Steve King, David Young, or will their campaigns say, stay away?
I think Steve King would very much be happy, be very happy to have Mr. Trump here. David Young, I don't think I'd be surprised if he had him campaign for him. Rod Blum, he might well, but I think King would be the most likely to have Mr. Trump here.
Stay where you are. Dennis Goldford, we need you more in the second half hour for your analysis. Professor of Political Science and Department Chair at Drake University, Dennis is with us for the second half hour after a short break. We'd like you to join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. When we come back, we want to talk about the DNC and the controversy caused by Donna Brazile with the launch of her new book, also an update on tax reform efforts by the GOP, maybe some comments on the latest in the Russia investigation. It's Politics Wednesday. I'm Ben Kiefer, back with Dennis Goldford in just a moment.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors. Dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
And we're back midstream in this Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Ben Kiefer with Dennis Goldford, Professor of Political Science, Department Chair at Drake University in our Des Moines studio, talking about the election results from yesterday, to what degree they portend things to come or playbooks to be played by the respective political parties. Dennis, let's go to a caller. Emily is with us in Lamoni. Hi, Emily.
Hi, hello.
Welcome to our program. What is on your mind given yesterday's results?
A lot of Democrats won, and I think that's really exciting. I'm an independent, but I'm more left-leaning. But I agree, the focus does not need to be on anti-Trump. Democrats need to find what they're going to run off of and have answers and solutions to problems instead of being anti-Trump. I really resonated with what one of the professors had to say about Hillary's message was, I'm not Trump and I'm a woman, and we need something more substantial than that. Mm-hmm. We need people with real life solutions for middle class Americans and Americans who are struggling to meet their daily needs. This is coming from someone who's a student living in a small town. There's a lot of poverty, very much right leaning ideologies, and it's just very confrontatious. It doesn't really seem, it's very emotionally charged between the ideologies and the left and the right. And I would like to just see more policy and proposals and how we're going to move forward. And also not just Democrats, but also Republicans figure out what they stand for, because I think both parties are really divided.
Mm, interesting. Emily, thanks for your reaction to the election results yesterday and going forward here. Dennis, you know, the wish for policy discussions to be front and center, can that happen in this era of divisiveness and identity politics?
It's difficult. I would ask Emily, if she's still listening, to consider, you know, what particular policy, what particular issue is the most important one to her, and why is she an independent?
Emily's still there, I think.
Oh, good.
Are you there, Emily?
Yeah, I'm here.
Well, Emily,
can you hear me?
Yes. Why are you an independent as opposed, say, to a supporter of one party or the other? What's most important to you?
For me personally, it's because I'm so young and I have a lot to learn and I don't understand all of it. And I want to remain open-minded. I care very much about our economical state in America, which a lot of Republicans tend to emphasize. And I really care about social issues and the environment and our foreign relationships, which Democrats generally tend to emphasize. So I want to keep my mind open. I don't want to settle. I care about our country first and foremost than I do identity politics. I do feel like I have very strong convictions in certain areas, but I also want to remain open and not be arrogant mm-hmm. about it.
That's very nice. Did you vote last November, Emily?
Yes, I did.
Good for you. Good for you. Okay.
Emily, thanks for your views once again from Lamoni. Thanks, Emily.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Emily joined us on this Politics Day.
That was very refreshing.
What exactly refreshing did you find there, Dennis?
Well, she's obviously interested. She understands that politics matters for so many young people. They don't see that politics matters. And too often, young people are purists, and I'm sure I've talked about this on the show before, that oftentimes people are waiting and think of politics as waiting for a knight in shining armor to ride up on a white charger and save the day. And that's not the way politics works. No matter what your point of view, one of the candidates is always less bad than the other candidate. And you may not want to participate that way, but that's politics. But sometimes people will say, well, neither one's perfect, so I'm not voting. So I was very pleased to hear that Emily was informed enough and thought the process important enough to have voted. That was great.
Mm-hmm. Dennis, let's move on to problems within the Democratic Party as we gear up for the 2018 campaign. We've been talking about it on this program. We also seem unable to leave the 2016 campaign behind, of course, because of the Russian meddling, the hacking, but also because of what was written in a new book by the former interim Democratic National Committee chair, Donna Brazile. It's something that has many Democrats shaken and angered. About how in this book she says she discovered that the Clinton campaign had essentially rigged the DNC, if not the primary itself, in Clinton's favor long before she became the nominee. In interviews here, Brazile seriously considered replacing Hillary Clinton on the ticket with Vice President Biden. That was after that collapse that Hillary Clinton had at the 9/11 memorial service in 2016. Also, Brazile, in this book, describing the Clinton campaign as badly mismanaged and spiritless. Let's listen to a little bit of Donna Brazile in an appearance on ABC responding to whether she had the power to remove Clinton from the ticket.
No, but as you well know, the charter of the DNC, as well as the conventional rules, say that the chairperson shall, in consultation with the leadership in Congress and others. And so I had to put it on the table, George, because I was under tremendous pressure after Secretary Clinton fainted to have a quote-unquote plan B. I didn't want a plan B. Plan A was great for me. I supported Hillary, and I wanted her to win.
Okay. What do you make of this controversy that's come up within the last few days, Dennis?
It validates some of the claims that the Sanders people made, and recall that it was alleged, if not proven, that Donna Brazile herself had fed some debate questions in advance to Hillary Clinton. So it's not as though she were working with from a neutral position. But at the same time, it was very clear that the Democratic establishment, I won't say had it fixed for Hillary, but she was the person that was going to be the nominee. And the superdelegates were all lined up for her. And to some extent, other than Martin O'Malley, you know, the Democratic problem was there was no bench. In other words, likely other candidates, and everybody always imagines himself as, or herself as a candidate. For the Democrats, they had been wiped out in the midterms in 2010 and 2014. They lost their offices, which is why the Democrats haven't done their generational shift yet. But clearly that the party establishment figured it would be Hillary and welcomed the possibility of Hillary becoming the nominee. And this irritated the Sanders supporters tremendously. And just as Donald Trump was a kind of hostile takeover of the Republican Party, as I said, his strongest supporters are Trump people first before they're Republicans. In many ways, in the Democratic Party, the regulars thought they were viewing a hostile takeover by the Sandernistas, by the Bernie Sanders supporters. The question for Democrats now going into the election in the midterms and then, of course, looking ahead to 2020 is – Do the Clinton regulars and the Sanders people, do they hate each other more than they hate Trump, or do they hate Trump more than they hate each other and therefore would be willing to work together? And that the jury's out on that one.
What about, you know, we had Emily as an independent, a self-described left-leaning independent. What about people who say, you know, I've lost some faith, some trust in the Democratic Party because of what's been revealed here?
That's obviously a problem for the Democrats. On the other hand, it's not something that surprises anybody. I mean, it was while there were many people running in 1980 in the Republican primaries and caucuses, it was clearly going to be Ronald Reagan's nomination to lose.
Not surprising, but I mean, I think a lot of people who called into this program, perhaps when you were on, you know, thought it was, let's just put it in quotation marks, a fair fight. Mm-hmm. Bernie supporters thought that the best candidate wins, and that's the way it was set out, the rules of the game.
Well, in many ways, it was a fair fight. Again, a lot of Sanders people and others will argue that you shouldn't have the superdelegates, but that's a separate issue. It just happened to be that the superdelegates supported Clinton, and the Sanders people weren't above appealing to the support of the superdelegates late in the campaign. But yeah, I mean, there was a famous book written in 2008 called The Party Decides, and that was the argument that basically party elites and big donors and all those folks decide pretty much in advance who they're going to back and who the candidate is likely to be. And there was a lot of talk about how that did not work on the Republican side this year, but it clearly worked, that particular theory about how these things happen, that was clearly accurate on the Democratic side. And the Sanders campaign was a bigger challenge to the Clinton campaign than the Clinton folks anticipated. But ultimately, they didn't have the delegates. And the level of enthusiasm was very different. And it was huge on the part of the Sanders folks. And when I went to the Jefferson Jackson Day dinner, the difference in enthusiasm was just amazing. And I've seen a lot of those. But their candidate lost. And in primaries, a candidate does, other candidates lose, one person emerges. That's the difficulty with primaries, as somebody of, as William Sapphire, not Sapphire, but who did the making of the president? You know, Theodore White, I think it was, once said that the primaries are like fights within the family, and fights within the family are nastier and leave lingering hatreds and hurts much more than fights against somebody outside the family.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to Nick. Nick joining us from Des Moines with Dennis Coldford. Nick, hi, you're on the air. What's your question for Dennis?
Hello, thank you for taking my call. I guess it's kind of twofold. One is when we look at 2018, how are both the parties going to position themselves? Because I don't think Virginia or New Jersey was really a surprise. Traditionally, Virginia's governor has always gone opposite of the president, and New Jersey, after the Christie fiasco, was basically all but done for. And similarly, I see that both parties appear to be just kind of hemorrhaging millennials, because as our previous caller said, they don't like where they sit. I myself am independent as well. So if you want to kind of tackle that, I know there's a lot of ground to cover there. But where does 2018 go for the both the parties, I guess, is the bigger question.
Nice question, Nick.
Sure. The first point to make is the political landscape. It favors the Republicans. Aside from turnout issues, which, as I said, always favors Republicans in midterm years, unless the Democrats can actually motivate their base, especially millennials, to turn out. But you have on the Senate side, because of just the way the cycle goes, remember, a third of the Senate is up for reelection every 2 years. And this would be the class of 2012 that ran for the Senate when President Obama ran for his second term. And the Democrats had a very good year that year. But the result is that you have eight Republican states with their senators. Eight Republican senators are up for reelection. So they have to defend those eight. 25 Democratic senators are up for reelection. They have to defend all those seats, and 10 of those seats are in states that actually went for Trump in 2016, like Montana and Missouri and a few others. Now, Iowa's not part of all that because we don't have a Senate race next year. So on the one hand, that's a tough battle for Democrats. On the other hand, all they need is a three-vote flip, a three-seat flip to regain control of the Senate. There's a 241 to 194 margin for the Republicans in the House. So the Democrats would have to lose, go down to 218, whatever that math is at the moment, 23 seats, 24 seats. Democrats would have to pick up 24 seats in the House. But that's tougher in the House. But again, they can narrow that margin. But again, it all depends upon turnout. If the Democrats can get their voters, especially single women, young people, and racial minorities to turn out, but they're the ones who vote the least.
Okay, Nick in Des Moines, thanks for that call. Let's get to a couple of other items before we end this edition of Politics Wednesday on River to River. Tax reform, Dennis. Efforts by the congressional Republicans to pass a major tax overhaul. This would be their first policy accomplishment, major legislative accomplishment, I should say. Where is this? Where do you see it? Because we've got the House, we've got the Senate, we've got a lot of ideas being tossed around with a basic framework, right?
Right. Tax cuts and tax reform, and those are two different things. Cuts means simply people pay less. Tax reform means the very system itself in terms of what kinds of things are taxed at what sorts of rates. That's a different thing. Republicans would like that more systematic approach, but they believe they may have to deal with simply cutting taxes. But either way, reforming taxes or cutting taxes, those make Republican hearts beat extremely fast. And they see that as their signature issue. And the last major tax reform was actually in 1986, but a lot of people forget that that was done on a bipartisan basis. It's been a long week already. That was done on a bipartisan basis, and in this particular situation, Republicans have set it up, particularly in the Senate, with this arcane process called reconciliation that lets them avoid the possibility of a filibuster. They have a majority in the House, and they've set it up so that they could do this with a simple majority in the Senate. Now, the problem is for Republicans is that various elements in this bill, and it gets really deep in the weeds in a hurry, and we don't want to do that, has a tremendous impact, particularly on higher tax states, so-called blue states, where a lot of Democrats live. In some ways, you could argue that their tax plan deliberately tries to be burdensome, if not punishing, toward Democratic states. But there are Republican legislators, Republican members of the House in those states. And they don't want to have to run defending a tax cut or tax reform that actually raises taxes for a lot of their constituents. So Republicans have to balance the concern of Republicans from states like New York and Pennsylvania and California, as well as dealing with their own tax hardliners. Mm-hmm. So it's tremendously complicated. The devil's always in the details. And one study I saw, for example, suggested that if you add up how much money would be cut in terms of taxes, and of course the Republican belief is that this will not blow a hole in the deficit, although it will add to it, but they believe that it will be made up through increased economic activity. That's the old supply side idea, and most people believe that doesn't work, but some believe it still does. But the study suggested that 50% of the benefit of tax cuts would go to the top 1% of households. And in fact, 25% of tax cuts would go to the top 0.1% of households. So the Republicans will say over and over this is a middle class tax cut. But number one, there might be some upfront cuts, but in the long run, will they pay more or less because of change in what's deductible? And at the same time, the really big money goes to the really big earners.
Mm-hmm. About 5 minutes left. Dennis, I'm going to wrap a couple things up in one for you to comment on, if you could. We haven't had you on. This is the first time you've been on since the major announcements of the Russia investigation, that guilty plea deal, and the two indictments that we had last week, the big news. But also this week's news, wrap it into the fact that 1 year ago this week, Donald Trump surprised almost everyone, including his supporters, by winning the White House in the Electoral College. Trump supporters euphoric, Clinton supporters stunned, catatonic, a lot of other words for what Clinton supporters, Democrats, experienced. I wonder, given that hindsight, 9+ months, of President Trump in office, how would you say the mood of the various political camps has changed in the past year?
Nobody's happy. I mean, Republicans, I think, I mean, Democrats obviously were devastated by what happened, although even Hillary Clinton said that she's encountered people and some people have come up to her and said, boy, you know, if I thought it might have been that close, I wish I would have voted. You know, that sort of thing that, you know, she got only 76%, I think it was, of the Obama vote among certain groups. But on the Republican side, again, I think Republicans had a kind of transactional view of Donald Trump. Most regular Republicans really didn't care for Trump. But as I said earlier, they thought they could use him for their purposes. There wouldn't be a President Obama or a President Clinton in the White House vetoing measures passed by a Republican Congress. And they thought Mr. Trump would sit quietly in the White House and just sign whatever legislation they sent up to him. But that's not Donald Trump. He's a showman. He likes to be on camera. Ratings are very important to him. He likes to tweet and always get his name out there all the time. So I think Republicans, other than perhaps Steve King or people in the Freedom Caucus in the House who are kind of – they were kind of Trumpists before there was Trump. I think most Republicans are not quite comfortable with and happy with Mr. Trump either at this point, and they're terrified of facing their constituents with nothing to show for all the promises they made of what they would do when they got into power.
Mm-hmm. Every president, especially outsiders, have a steep learning curve when they step into the Oval Office to lead the country. I wonder, have you seen changes in the way Donald Trump is leading from the initial weeks that he spent in the White House when we compare him with other modern presidents?
Well, I think there's a lack of humility. You have to know what you don't know, and you have to know which advisors to trust, and you have to be able to recognize when your advisors know what they're talking about and when they don't. I remember the astounding comment from President Trump when he said with regard to health care, you know, who knew it was this difficult, or who knew this was complex? Well, everybody knew that, evidently, except for you. So he's had a steeper learning curve. There's still a kind of differential, I can't think of the word I'm looking for at the moment. They're two different Trumps. There's the Trump that spontaneous gets on Twitter and says and other forums and says all these kinds of inflammatory things. And there's the Trump who stands before a teleprompter and reads something, sounds almost medicated in the way he comes across reading these things. And they keep him more online when he does that. But the real Trump is the spontaneous Trump on Twitter and when he speaks off the cuff.
Okay. Ending my conversation with Chris, I asked him something along these lines. I'll end with you. We have just a less than a minute left. Okay, let me put it this way, Dennis. Trump, the GOP members of Congress will stay aboard the Trump train as long as what doesn't happen?
Well, if it becomes clear that he has actually done something that is clearly illegal or would amount to a high crime or misdemeanor, then some may begin to peel away. But again, Republicans got on the tiger years ago when they fostered this kind of populist anger and rage, and it's come to fruition for them in Donald Trump. And the question is whether they can get off that tiger without getting eaten alive. Because while Chris said that maybe they're about 38% approval, maybe Trump's bottom is about 30% or so, supposedly the really hardcore Trump vote is 25%, and they will see it. They'd be incredibly enraged if Republicans contribute to moving Trump out of office.
Always a pleasure to have you on. Dennis Goldford, Professor of Political Science, Department Chair at Drake University. Thank you so much for your insights this hour. It's been too long. Glad to have you back on the program today.
Let's do it again soon.
All right. Thanks. River to River is produced by Ben Stanton, Emily Woodbury, and Lindsay Moon, with help from Robbie Broad, also from Tony Daner and John Pemble this hour. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.